Hello, this is Chair Ruth Richardson. Pursuant to House Rule 10.1, I call this remote meeting of the Education Policy Committee to order. We will start with a roll call for attendance, please.
Chair Richardson?
Present.
Vice Chair Hassan? Vice Chair Hassan?
Present. I can mute.
Representative Erickson?
Present.
Representative Drazkowski?
Present.
Representative Bennett? Representative Bennett?
I think Representative Bennett will be late. Sorry to interfere, but I think she's in another meeting.
Thank you. Representative Berg?
Present.
Representative Bo? Representative Christensen?
Present.
Representative Edelson?
Present.
Representative Feist?
Present.
Representative Frazier?
Present.
Representative Jordan?
Present.
Representative Keeler?
Present.
Representative Moeller?
Present.
Representative Mueller?
Present.
Representative Poston? Representative Poston? Representative Scott? Representative Erdahl? Representative Erdahl? Representative Waslowick?
Present.
Representative Poston?
Present.
Representative Erdahl? Madam Chair, a quorum is present.
Thank you, Ellen. Next, we'll move on to the approval of the minutes from the January 13th meeting. Representative Moeller, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes? If so, thank you.
I have, Madam Chair, and I move to approve the minutes.
Thank you, Representative Moeller. All in favor? Say aye.
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 Any opposed? Thank you. The minutes are approved. The committee rules have been distributed and they're in the committee packet. It's worth noting that due to the remote nature of the meetings and after consulting with House Research, the CLA will be calling the roll call for attendance and motions to re-refer bills when we are remote. But calling the roll will not be required for approving minutes or adopting amendments. It's also a good time to note that because all of the hearings are being live streamed, we must end on time. We can't go over even a minute or two because it throws challenges to our staffing team. So we will be planning on ending on time. And with that, our plan is to also take a roll call today on the re-referral of the bill that we will be hearing at 2:25 in order to keep us on track. So we will now turn our attention to House File 4. Rep Hassan, would you like to move your bill to get it properly before the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move House File 4 to be re-referred to Education Finance.
And Vice Chair Hassan, I understand that you also have an author's amendment.
Yes, I do, Madam Chair.
Would you like to move that that A1 amendment?
I move A1 amendment.
All in favor, say aye of moving the A1 amendment.
Aye.
Any opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted and the bill is in the shape the author would like. You may proceed, Vice Chair Hassan.
Madam Chair and members, 2020 has been a challenging year with a pandemic that has taken too many lives, closed our schools, restaurants, and confined many of us to our homes, as well as the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police officer, followed by the civil unrest that burned down our cities. I can safely say that we're in the midst of a continuous trauma, and I hope and pray 2021 proves to be a better year for all of us. COVID-19 pandemic has taken a toll on all of our systems, especially on our education system. It has worsened our opportunity gap and left many of our vulnerable students struggling like never before. The students are already coping with mental health conditions. Students who are already coping with mental health conditions and those with disabilities have been especially vulnerable to the challenge of distance learning. According to research, nearly 30% of students are struggling with some sort of impact on their mental health. These students are not only missing their classrooms alone, they're missing out friendships, extracurricular activities, future planning, and compassionate school staff who help them build self-esteem and cope with peer pressure. Many mental health experts worry about the psychological toll on a younger generation that was already experiencing soaring rates of depression, anxiety, and suicide before the pandemic. It's worth noting that our Black, Indigenous, and students of color have been struggling in our education system prior to this pandemic. Research has proven that factors such as race, gender, ethnicity, and income can make it difficult for certain students to keep up with their peers from different backgrounds and social classes. We know and understand how critical education is to the future of our state and our economy. So investing in education better and figuring out a way to minimize the opportunity gap widened by this pandemic is an economic strategy for all of us. Today, I present to you House File 4. This bill includes a wide range of provisions that represent our approach to address the impact of COVID-19 on students as well as the broader education system. This bill includes several provisions. First provision is wraparound support for students. We're spending $2 million on service schools and hiring coordinators on accelerated time for 6 months instead of the normal time. Community schools for 10 to 15 schools to hire coordinators on an accelerated timeline so they can implement a full service community model this coming fall. Each recipient school will work with parents, students, and teachers to identify needs, their needs and prior via a comprehensive need assessment. The second part is $6 million on appropriation to funding for trauma-informed coaching training for school staff who work with students to increase support to students with adverse childhood experience to promote restorative practice and strengthen non-exclusionary discipline in schools. As we know, mental health is going to be a huge impact moving forward with our students. And this, shows that we care about our students' emotional well-being and we're investing money on it. This may not be it. We might need more money in the future, but we're starting on this. The next part of this is, we're appropriating $3 million for math corps and $2 million for reading corps to implement intervention program both during the school year and summer school to address math and reading deficiencies related to COVID-19. The next part, we're spending $5 million to ignite after school, re-grant after school program providers services to significant percentage of students with disabilities or students of color that provide culturally specific supports to students or who have staff that reflect racial and ethnic diversity of students served. As we all know that, we had opportunity gap that is one of the worst in the nation. And the pandemic has worsened that opportunity gap. And our Black, Indigenous, and students of color are struggling. So this appropriation would help with after-school programs. And then the other spending on this bill, we're spending a one-time flexibility for school posts to provide an extended school day and a school year programming to address educational services disrupted or caused by the pandemic. And the next part, in the next provision, it talks about an appropriation to school districts to serve students with disabilities in the summer of 2021. Districts receiving this grant must offer a summer programming for students with disabilities, regardless of whether a student's IEP requires the district to provide summer instructions and support. And the next part of this bill, we're making several policy change and clarifications to improve the delivery of special education to our students. The first one requires school board that's developing or updating a plan to provide an on-site instruction or to prioritize an on-site instruction for students with IEP that requires instructions in federal 3 or 4 level. Those who are spending the majority of their school day in a classroom, in a class special ed room. Special ed classroom, sorry, or students with disabilities who are also identified as English learners. What this part is doing is prioritizing students who have IEP and special ed, and are receiving special educations, as well as students who are English learners. The second part clarifies that school district may provide services required to students IEP to a student that is at student's home. And that if a student school provide those services, those services qualify for special education funding. The second part just talks about, for school districts to consider, students a disability when, dealing with truancy issue. We know that, Black, Indigenous, and students of color are disproportionately impacted when it comes to, either suspension or expulsion. And we have seen that skyrocket during, distance learning. So this one, I would have loved that this, to even, broaden this to all students, but this part only talks about to consider when your school is trying to figure out what the issue of truancy is or whether they should report the truancy or not, they consider a student's disability. This last part talks about a 1 year extension of eligibility, special education. As we know that, there are students who are in transition who may be aging out because of, you age out to 18 to 21, those students in transition age out. But we also know that many of the, their placement, entities that they would have been normally placed at may have been closed or are, currently closed and may reopen in the future. So what this part is doing is that instead of those students who have aged out of transition sitting at home and doing nothing, which also goes back to like the mental health, aspect of this, like, if you sit at home and do nothing, even if you don't have a disability or if you don't have an IEP, you are going to, develop some sort of mental health issues. So this part just says that even if the student aged out of transition, we're going to extend one more year in the hope that, in a year, this pandemic will be over and this student will have a placement. And then the last part of this bill talks about, ensuring that a school district or charter school's general education aid will be calculated using the greater of the adjusted pupil unit count of either the current school year or prior school year. We know that there are 8,300 families who have not enrolled for this current school year. So if we cut, school budget based on that, and then, in the year 2021-2022 school year, all of those families want to come back. That means that, They would have to rehire the staff that you know, they let go. They would have to restart programs, restructure their school. So, and this, you know, to stabilize school funding, this part, it says that we're not going to, you know, cut that funding because of the temporary decrease in enrollment. We know that those families are going to come back. So instead of like putting a burden on school saying that, okay, because you had, you know, less students enrolled in this year, we're going to cut this much money from you. We're just saying that we're going to, you know, go by either current school year or prior school year. That's how we're going to fund you and not go by the temporary decrease in enrollment. And I believe that concludes the walkthrough part of the bill for me. I know that we have multiple testifiers who are going to talk about this bill and why we need this bill, even though I believe that all of us know why we need this bill. So, Madam Chair, I don't know who's the first the person that's testified in line, but now we can go to testifiers. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Hassan, for presenting the bill. Members, we are tracking those with hands up. We will hold questions until the end of all of the testimony, and we will also ensure that we're tracking the order of which hands have been raised as well. Laura Taken-Holtze, I believe, is putting the list of testifiers in order, and it looks like she is identifying who's up and then also the individual who will be going next. So we will start with the Executive Director of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, Scott Krunquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Scott Krunquist, and I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. AMSD represents 49 school districts or intermediate cooperative districts that collectively enroll more than one half of the state's public school students. And I want to thank Representative Hassan for sponsoring this very important legislation that addresses some real significant challenges facing our school districts and our students in the midst of this pandemic. I've been asked to focus on sections 1 and 3, and several of my colleagues will address other provisions. As Representative Hassan noted, section 1 addresses the COVID-19 related enrollment decline. And I'm guessing many of you have heard a lot about this from your local school officials. We conducted a survey this last fall of our member districts to ascertain how much their enrollment had declined from what they had anticipated when they adopted their budget last June. The survey showed us that our school districts have 11,295 fewer students enrolled this fall than they had anticipated. That translates into a reduction in revenue of approximately $74 million from what our districts had anticipated. That obviously presents a significant budget challenge, and House File 4 would be a tremendous help in addressing that. I also want to express our support for Section 3 of the bill, which would grant school boards flexibility to provide extended time opportunities for our students. As you are well aware, the distance learning environment has caused big challenges for many of our students. One of the top priorities of our school districts right now is identifying those students who have struggled in the distance learning environment so we can provide them the extra supports and opportunities they need to be successful. Finally, I would just like to note a couple of issues that we would like to continue to work with Representative Hassan and others on as the bill moves forward. We very much support the goals outlined in Section 3 of the bill. There are just a few operational issues we'd like to address, and actually they're outlined in the written testimony that was submitted by the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education, and we think that they can be resolved easily. And then also would just like to point out that like the enrollment decline, our school districts have seen a significant reduction in the number of students and families who have completed the application for the free reduced price lunch program. And as you can imagine, the pandemic atmosphere has not been very conducive to trying to help and reach families to make sure that those applications have been completed. We greatly appreciate the legislation you all passed in the December special session, extending that deadline, and that helped. We got hundreds of additional applications in over those few weeks that you did extend that deadline. However, our districts are telling us that they still think there are a significant number of families who did not get that application completed. And we just want to make sure our students are going to have the resources and the nutrition that they need to be successful. So we'd like to work with you on that as the bill moves forward. So with that, I know you got a full agenda, Madam Chair and members. I'll stop there and thank you very much. And thank you, Representative Hassan, for bringing House File 4 forward.
Thank you. Up next, we have the Executive Director for the Minnesota Rural Education Association, Bob Indahar. And then next on deck, we will have Denise Dietrich.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Bob Indahar. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Education Association, or MREA. MREA represents almost 230 school districts from every corner of Greater Minnesota and 30 cooperative educational entities that serve students. We try to bring a unique, broad perspective to education issues, as our board is comprised of elected school board members, administrators, teachers, higher education, and cooperative representatives. I'm here today to lend our support and appreciation for House File 4. Thank you, Representative Hassan, for this bill, which seeks to improve students recover from any learning loss they experience during the pandemic. This is an important issue to address. Rural schools are proud of the work that they have done to safely keep students in school as much as possible this year. However, they face financial challenges due to COVID impacts. As we started this school year, we were looking at almost every district losing state aid because of reduced pupil counts. You saw this reflected in the November budget forecast as the education budget declined by $118 million. Now, part of the loss of state aid was due to the decline in compensatory aid, as the fall 2019 free and reduced count was much better than the fall of 2020. Much of this had to do with parents no longer needing to fill out free and reduced forms to have their children receive free lunches. House File 4 doesn't address the compensatory issue, but just know this could be an issue that districts are going to be facing in their budgets. I just wanted to make a note of that. However, House File 4 does address the raw pupil count issue many districts are facing, and we appreciate your fast action on this issue. Districts do not want to lay off good staff, and your help in stabilizing their budgets could spare many people an otherwise unnecessary layoff notice. We're hopeful the loss of pupils is temporary and that they will return next year. In addition to the pupil revenue stabilization provision in Section 1, I want to note our general support for the provisions in the rest of the bill, from expanding our ability to provide summer and after-school programs to finding providers to help with wraparound services. There is a lot of work that needs to be done to help students recover in their educational work and to help with their social and emotional needs. I do want to note how proud we are of rural staff for going the extra mile this school year, making in-person education work as much as possible. One issue we may need your help addressing is staffing for summer and after-school programs. We may need help with flexibility for staffing with extended learning, as our core teaching staff will be exhausted from the full year or more of COVID education. There's a great likelihood that districts may have difficulty finding staff for these programs. We look forward to working with you on this bill and other legislation needed to ensure schools are ready to recover and thrive in the wake of the pandemic. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have the Minnesota School Boards Association, Denise Dietrich, and on deck, Maren Holden.
Good afternoon, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. My name is Denise Dietrich, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota School Boards Association and the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. We want to begin by thanking Representative Hassan for introducing House File 4 as one of the House's top priorities this legislative session. I am today speaking in support of Section 1, which has already been discussed at length, but more specifically, I am going to speak to Section 3, one-time extended time flexibility, giving school boards by resolution the flexibility needed for extended school day and year programming to address the COVID-19 disruption of the education services for students. The additional flexibility in Section 3 is vitally important to students as they transition back to in-person classroom learning. We know that some students did fare well under distance learning, but many have not. For those students who have experienced learning loss, this flexibility is a much needed tool for school districts to address that learning loss. As we all know, extended time learning provides additional alternative opportunities for students to become proficient on grade level and/or on track to graduate. The value of extended time services has been recognized by the Office of Legislative Auditor, and I'm going to read the findings, please. We found that elementary and middle school students who attended extended time alternative education programs, such as before or after school programs or summer school, showed higher than expected growth on two standardized assessments when compared to other students and national norms. However, the Minnesota Department of Education has limited the school districts that may provide these programs. And finally, they conclude, we recommend that the legislature allow all school districts to provide these alternative education programs. Maximum flexibility is needed so that school districts can address the learning for those who may already be behind. We simply cannot add to the disparities, especially those racial and socioeconomic disparities that already exist for some of our students. In closure, extended learning is a critical tool, and additional flexibility would be appreciated as school districts in the months to come design more robust programs to mitigate learning loss due to the pandemic. And with that, I'll conclude my comments. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Maren Holden from the Legal Services Advocacy Project. And on deck, we have Julie Ruzek, rather. Ms. Holden.
Thank you so much, Chair Richardson, and thank you to all the members, and thank you to Representative Hassan, too, for bringing this important bill. My name is Maren Holden, and I'm an attorney at Legal Aid, which includes the Minnesota Disability Law Center. The Disability Law Center, we provide free legal services to children and adults with disabilities, including on school-related issues. So we have been hearing from parents and kids across the state about their needs during this time, and I'm going to speak to the special education provisions in this bill, which we are very supportive of, in addition to many of the other great things that this bill does. You know, despite tremendous efforts by educators, lots of students have not been getting what they need from the learning models available during COVID-19. Some students have done well, but there are a lot of students with disabilities across the state for whom distance learning just doesn't work. So, you know, some children can't or won't engage with screens. Some students need close assistance from an adult. Other students need extremely consistent routines in order to participate in academic tasks. And others need speech therapy, occupational therapy, or other therapies in order to not lose ground on skills. And so this disruption has meant that many students simply aren't receiving a benefit from school, and others are actually regressing. And families are struggling too. We've heard so many stories of parents who've had to quit their jobs, and you know, families in untenable financial circumstances without the support of school that we're used to. We and other advocates have done surveys of families and have been really overwhelmed with some firsthand responses. And so I'm just gonna read a couple that we've received. From a parent in a metro district, our daughter is a 13-year-old student starting eighth grade. She has not had any form of school, distance or in person, since schools were closed in March 2020. She has significant disabilities, which make distance learning inaccessible for her, even with modifications from school. She's nonverbal, she can't write or type. She is unable to attend or participate in class virtually as she cannot watch a teacher on a screen. While in school, she's in a self-contained classroom with a one-to-one aide. She has a 25-page IEP and not one of her IEP goals or services are being met or provided through distance learning. This one from a parent in a suburban district. In a typical school year, my son receives full-time one-on-one support from a paraprofessional. He's multiple grade levels below and has difficulty focusing, mild intellectual disability, and delayed growth, spine, and speech skills. Before school started, I asked for in-home support and was originally told no. He's not able to follow along or complete tasks required of his general education class. If I leave him at the computer, he closes it. Without one-to-one support, my son will be left to a wasted year of an education experience and he's not able to participate in and will continue to fall even farther behind his peers. This is from a parent in Greater Minnesota. My child needs to be in person school at least 4 days a week to learn something this year. She cannot go on Google Meets or to do any of her work unless I'm home because she can't navigate the iPad on her own. I also work, so she misses out on all Google Meets and Zoom meetings that happen during the day, 8 to 5. The school offered to give her a paraprofessional on an iPad, and then she and my child can FaceTime from my computer and do work that way. But again, that can only be done when I'm home to assist with technology and making sure she and the para are on the same assignment. It's very difficult to do distance learning without proper supports. These stories have been really heartbreaking for us and other advocates to hear, even though we know that the governor, MDE, and that educators and districts are working so hard to serve students right now. We still continue to hear about children struggling across the state. And so I'm really grateful that this committee is considering the approaches in House File 4, which would bring some statewide solutions to this problem. Specifically, Section 4 of House File 4 is focused on children who have disabilities. And this would help in a few ways, as Representative Hassan outlined, you know, making sure that we're prioritizing students who have disabilities for in-person learning. This is a really good direction. We really think it's important to support prioritizing students with disabilities and English language learners who need in-person instruction the most. Home visits are something families have really been asking for, and we're grateful for this provision too. An unfortunate consequence of the pandemic is that when a family can't make it work for a student to log on, like parents are working or the student refuses, as you heard in one of the stories, that can really impact attendance and under our current laws trigger truancy. So this provision would give districts the flexibility to take a student's disability into consideration before making truancy referrals. And then finally, you know, the crunch of this pandemic, and I've heard others say that it's kind of like we're really losing a year, is felt so significantly for Minnesota's oldest public education students who are really missing their last chances to benefit from public education. And so this fourth subdivision would waive the age cutoff so that students with disabilities who haven't been able to receive their last year of special education services can. I understand there's a little work to do on some of these provisions, as one of the other testifiers mentioned, and I'm eager to continue working with the author and other stakeholders on this language so it can best serve students with disabilities in Minnesota. Thank you so much, Chair Richardson and Representative Hassan, for your leadership on this, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. Julie Rezek and Will Ruffin on deck.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Julie Rezek. I'm the District Coordinator of Family and Community Partnerships at Rochester Public Schools. I support a number of initiatives and programs in the district, one of these being the implementation of the full-service community schools model at four of our sites. Currently, our community school sites include two elementary schools, Gage and Riverside Central, and two high schools, John Marshall and our Rochester Alternative Learning Center. The community schools model is not a program or a curriculum. It's an initiative, a mindset that is adopted and organically implemented at each site. This strategy allows us to align school and community resources and opportunities for student success. We follow the community school guidelines set forth by both the Minnesota Statute and the National Coalition for Community Schools. Our work is guided by four pillars: integrated student supports, expanded and enriched learning time and opportunities, active family and community engagement, and collaborative leadership and practices. Full service community schools can be implemented anywhere, in any town, in any building, and are a strategy for equity. At the district level, we've built solid relationships with internal and external partners. The United Way of Olmsted County provides backbone support in the form of physical and personnel resources. This year, we worked with the United Way to honor the commitment of family and community members who sit on our leadership teams by providing them an annual honoraria. We value the time commitment of all members on these teams. We have also built strong relationships with Olmsted County Health, Housing, and Human Services, Olmsted County Public Health, Mayo Clinic, Channel One Food Bank, and many, many other for-profit and nonprofit partners. We can only do this work through collaboration with our partners. We believe that it was our relationships with partners that allowed us to quickly respond when the pandemic arrived last year. We were able to lean on existing partners and relationships that had been established through our full-service community school sites to support students district-wide. We used our knowledge of family resource rooms, which include food and basic need items, to create mobile resource buses. These buses went into areas within our community and delivered school meals and other basic needs and educational items to students and families. We used our knowledge of home visits and provided a framework for staff to do socially distanced porch visits to students and families across the community. And finally, we used our existing relationships with the medical professionals in our town to receive guidance and support in navigating the unknown waters of this pandemic. We are grateful for the full service community schools model and the opportunity to share what it means to our community. Thank you, Representative Hassan, for including full service community schools in your bill. Please continue to support funding for full service community schools. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Will Ruffin with the Community School Site Facilitator with Gage Elementary. And on deck, we have Lita Casper.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Will Ruffin II of Gage Elementary in Rochester, and I'm here today to speak on behalf of full service community schools. Over the past 12 years, I have served as a classroom teacher in the area of fifth grade. This year, I changed schools and switched roles from a classroom teacher to a community school site facilitator. And I can honestly say that my perspective around the needs of students has changed. I have a more of a bird's eye view of our building's needs and approaches to tackling those needs. I now see the pattern of students needing winter clothes, adequate shoes, food to eat, a consistent place to live, access to high-speed internet so the learning can continue while they're at home, clean clothes, and so many more. This is a much larger problem than I originally thought. We also know that there are students all over the state, and I would assume country, who are in similar situations. But most of all, and possibly more than anything else, our students need hope. They need to know that while they are in the midst of surviving a global pandemic, there are still good people in the world who are willing to lend a helping hand and help guide them through this most difficult time. This year, I've witnessed such hope occurring in Rochester Public Schools. I've watched my city rally around the need and cry for help from its citizens in a way that I've never witnessed before. And I've seen our full service community schools serve as a connection between the community and our students. For example, Rochester Public Schools continue to pass out hundreds of meals every week to families with children under the age of 18 who may be struggling with food security. The district also partnered with Channel One to provide hot meals to adults and their children. Sadly, that was funded by a grant that ended at the end of last year. Local churches pitched in with over 200 food bags so families could have food over the winter break, and yet we know that this simply isn't sustainable. The public library delivers basic needs of supplies to families who can make this request. Our school district was able to work with our local internet service providers to provide hotspots for families who don't have access to the internet while away from school. Local agencies have been able to provide rent assistance to families who are giving it their all and still coming up short. Our school has also partnered with local high school students in the Diversity Council of Rochester to provide mentoring to students needing extra human connection. Our Gage Elementary staff has graciously volunteered to read bedtime stories to our students every night over the past winter break. And we decided to continue doing this once a week throughout the end of the school year. You see, this type of collaboration and hope that can finally bridge the gap and restore some of the trust between different groups in our community, namely families and schools. This is the type of hope that can actually bring people together and show them that we can and will get through this pandemic together. The framework for full service community schools was in place before the pandemic, and it was that very framework and built relationships with community partners that allows us to be the hub of all those needs for our families. And that's why I'm here today. I ask you to please consider fully funding our full service community schools so that we can continue being the light of hope for the students and families in our communities. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. Lita Casper, the community school site facilitator with Riverside Elementary, is next. And on deck, we have Jem Spore Leader. And we will go to Lita Casper.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, and thank you, Representative Hassan. My name is Lita Casper, and I am fortunate to serve as the community school facilitator at Riverside Elementary School in Rochester. This role, this work, is personal to me, and so I can't explain it to you. I can't explain its critical importance to you without explaining to you a little bit of my why. As a child, I grew up with a single mother, a lovely and loving mother, but a mother who was fighting to live for as far back as I can remember. I have vivid recollections as a small child of riding on her bicycle seat to radiation treatment. In middle school, I remember cleaning out her trachea tube every morning before I left for school. I remember never knowing what home might be like when I got home. I became a teacher and a community school facilitator because I was lucky enough to have had a village of people who cared about me, despite a less than stellar school performance and despite making some poor decisions, but also making a few really lucky ones. Like most things in life, success is not always what you know. Sometimes it's who you know. I do this work because everyone deserves to have someone who they know. Because it matters what your resources are, it matters who your connections are, it matters who believes in you, and it matters who you're connected with, and that they reflect who you are and who you want to become. Through experiences, through opportunities, and through whole child partnerships facilitated by community schools. So let me tell you how community schools is a lever for some of these positive outcomes. Prior to COVID-19, Riverside installed a 1,000 square foot $60,000 community mural. It was designed and painted by our students, our families, and our community. This mural was paid for through grants, donations, and the generosity of our community, all facilitated through community schools partnerships. Why is this important? Because it matters that our students see themselves reflected larger than life at their school. Because it matters that students have access to enrichments, and it matters that our community is invested in our outcomes. Community schools foster this work every single day. As facilitators of two different elementary schools, Mr. Ruffin, who just spoke, and I know the power of partnership. For months, we have asked local leaders in our community to read children's books. The purpose of this was to celebrate leaders in our community reading books that are reflective of themselves and of the students who we serve. What happened was so much more. These read-alouds brought students to Javier's Barber Shop, to Miguel's Pato Apero Community Bike Club, to Doctora Jessica Garcia, and to Dr. Bain's office at Mayo Clinic, who read a book from his Tlingit tribe in Alaska. This simple opportunity facilitated by community schools became an opportunity for our students to have a window into our community, into careers, and into their futures.
And I could go on. I was going to ask if you could wrap up because
this is my last sentence. If I could go on and on, but please feel free to visit us virtually. As some of you already have, virtually or in person, as some of you already have. Today, I urge each of you to fully consider funding this movement and expand it across the state as a lever to college, career, and positive outcomes for all. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next up, we have from the National School Responsive, a consultant who does National School Trauma Responsive Training, Jem Spore Leader, we are excited to have you here today. And if you all have not seen the documentary Paper Tigers, it is definitely a must-see in terms of thinking through trauma responsiveness. And on deck, we'll have Dr. Peter Nelson.
Thank you, Chairman Richardson. It's a privilege to be a part of this today. And really want to express my gratitude to Representative Hassan for her vision and seeing the power of what a trauma responsive school model can bring to our kids. And my heart was just touched with Will and Lita's stories. That's what trauma responsive is. And so I've had the opportunity, and I'm grateful and humbled to be able to travel the nation and work with schools and help them in their journey in becoming trauma responsive. And I think one thing that I really want to share is becoming a trauma responsive school is the umbrella. It's the umbrella that's over our schools, and everything under it is aligned with what I call the power of one. And the power of one is my true understanding that one caring adult can change the life path of a child or another adult who has suffered a traumatic past. And in our educational system, I believe we were in crisis before the pandemic. Our kids have been hurting for some time, and we've got to bring some hope and healing to this environment, and making those special connections that can help them not feel like they have to live out their trauma or be defined with their trauma. These kids are just amazing. They don't know it. They're not in an environment that at home that reinforces the special person that they were meant to be. So as you look at a trauma responsive model and having schools take this on, I just want to share it's not a checklist of what we do, but it's who we become. And through my journey, it's who I've become. And though I'm retired, it hasn't changed anything. I still, if I know that one caring adult can change a life, then when in school, when we talk about our kids that are really hurting, then the discussion is how many more adults can we put intentionally in the student's life? How many positive intentions can I have in conversation with kids in a day? When I meet adults, whether it's an Uber driver, you know, a stewardess, a waiter, I am seeking positive interaction. And I really think that this connects with the inequality that we've seen and the disparity that we've seen. One thing that is still hurts my heart is that and this is nationally, we have come up with policies to reduce out-of-school suspensions, but in those areas that we've seen great improvement, you still look at the data and we're still putting kids of color out disproportionately than their peers for the same offense. And that's, we've got to deal with that. And through a trauma-responsive school model, there are simple data tools that we can monitor that. It's not, let's see at the end of the year how we did. No, let's be looking at it monthly. Let's be talking about it. And I do not know of one trauma responsive school that I've had contact with and that has truly accepted the knowledge and embedded the power of one that has not benefited from the fruits of their labor. And what do those fruits look like? It looks like improved attendance, improved GPA, improved testing scores. I'm not a big testing guy, but testing scores come up. Why? Because when I'm connected with that adult, I'm engaged with that adult. Do I have bad days? Absolutely. But I have a relationship, I have safety, and I know that trusting adult that loves me unconditionally is gonna help me through that difficult time. And so for some of our kids that are disruptive, that disruption gets further and further apart. For some of our kids that are hurting so bad, we gotta walk with them side by side and help them and teach them and coach them along the way, but it is through the connectiveness and the caring adult that we're gonna get the results that we want and that the kids deserve. So those graduation rates, they go up. Now, when I first went to Lincoln High School, I went there because I read a report about what the kids are saying about themselves and what the staff is saying about themselves. I asked to go to the school. It wasn't called Lincoln. It was called Payne Alternative High School. When I got there, I knew I was going in for a tough job, but I had no clue of just how out of control that environment was. The gangs in that building had control, and they did not want to give it up for the new principal that just came in. And it took us almost a year just to get it to where I could say, finally, that we've got a safe environment, because no child should ever come to school in fear. And so we worked so hard to create that. And there were days that I didn't know if I was going to make it. And through that, and through 3 years of trying to change that culture and give value to kids, I went to a conference called the Resiliency of Hope. And that's where I was introduced to toxic stress. I'd never heard about toxic stress. I learned about the brain being full of cortisol, that fight, flight, freeze mode. And what the most powerful part of that was is that I learned it went against everything I believed. See, I thought behavior was a choice. I thought every kid can learn. But what I learned through the science, and the science, there's great depths, is that if I'm in the middle to the stem of my brain, it's impossible for me to take in new knowledge. It's impossible for me to problem solve. I can't do it. An analogy of that is I'm stuck in locked in the trunk of the car and you're asking me to drive. Can't happen. And I heard that when a kid is in that position, it's also out of their control. And here I, two-thirds of my career, I'm thinking, behavior is a choice. You chose this. I got to teach you responsibility and all this and that. But when I learned these concepts, and I thank God for giving me such a wonderful staff that got behind my hyperness when I got back from the conference, because I'd said, we got to change. We can't go down the same path. And we started asking kids what was going on versus telling them what was going wrong. And they spoke to us. And that's where we found out the needs that were there. That's where we were able to start wrapping support around our kids. And I come from a community that our community partners came in. If we found out a family was out of food, we got to the food bank. If we heard that the electricity was going to be turned off, we got the electricity bill paid. We built relationships with those families. We became the safe adults for the families to come in and talk to us on unrelated things from school. We were kind of their crisis managers. I can't tell you how much the impact that the fire in my belly to change, to help bring a transformation to kids and to the people that we worked with, they gave me far more than what I was ever able to give them. My alumni kids today, they're 26, 27. They're still, I'm just amazed. When these kids get resilience, and resilience comes from us being able to nurture that relationship. And when that relationship is nurtured, then their resilience is built within them. It empowers them. And that's where we see their transformation begin. That's where we see them gaining confidence to see hope. And when I talk about disparity, a trauma-responsive mindset removes the disparity. Because remember, my whole intent is positive interaction with as many kids as I can and to develop as many positive, caring adult relationships that I possibly can. It's greeting kids that aren't even in my classroom when I see them in the hallway. It creates the culture. It becomes who I am, and it becomes who we are when we come together around this concept. it's needed. The other thing that I'd like to share is, you know, I've had the opportunity to work with school districts with 45,000 students. And when I go to those districts, it's, Jim, we're seeing behaviors like we've never seen before. When I go to a rural school district, it's the same story. We're seeing behaviors that we've never experienced before. A trauma responsive approach will change the culture of the school. It becomes our identity, and we will see change. The change is, and the fuel that fuels the fire in our belly is the kids' response in our relationships. Because when we start asking, they start telling. And that's what I can remember so many times asking a student, hey, what's going on? What caused that? And they started sharing, and in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, my God, I would have told them what they were doing wrong, and I would suspended them for 2 days. And what does that accomplish? Here the student tells me what's going on. I'm able to wrap support around them. And at the end of the conversation, I give them their consequence. They expect it. We hold them accountable, but that comes at the end of the conversation. And that's what builds that relationship and that trust and that safety. And with our kids in this pandemic environment, they are hurting so much more than I think what we really understand. Those kids that are disengaging, it's not because they don't care. They're in an environment that there's no support. If I'm in an abusive home, how am I supposed to get on a computer and concentrate? The teachers are working as hard as they can. They're under stress like they've never been before. So I'm so pleased with the direction that you're going and presentation of this bill. And I can't be any more grateful. And so I want to express that to you. I want to thank you. As you know, our kids need us. And Will and Lila shared it so well. So thank you for this time.
Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for also lifting up compassionate accountability with our students. It's very important. And so with that, we will move on to our next testifier.
Thank you.
We have Dr. Peter Nelson. You are up.
Thank you. So my name is Peter Nelson, and I'm the Director of Research at Serve Minnesota. Now, Serve Minnesota is our state's AmeriCorps Commission. And as an organization, we leverage the committed people and resources of AmeriCorps to address our state's critical issues. Now, we do this really well in Minnesota because from design to scale, our programs are rooted in evidence. They have a direct line to empirical research. And this allows us to know that our AmeriCorps members do things that have a known value to kids, and not just through testimonials, which we have, but through hard data. For example, Reading Corps and Math Corps have support from two different randomized controlled trials, each showing that the programs produce an additional semester of math gains and between a semester and a year of literacy gains for students. In both of these studies, the largest gains were among students of color and EL learners. Now, we also know how to create infrastructure on promising ideas to ensure those ideas find their way into practice in an effective and meaningful way, and replicable as well. Now, I want to just mention briefly that our collective efforts right now are so important because we know what we're facing. There are many great examples of schools doing online learning well, but with the shift to online and hybrid models of learning, there's going to be a decrease in opportunities to learn, to interact with folks, to receive feedback. And that decrease is going to affect everyone's achievement. Let's be honest about it. But it's really going to affect students who are growing up in under-resourced homes. All right, so opportunities to learn matter, but I think now more than ever, we need to find ways to create these opportunities for kids. Every minute that we can get our tutors in front of kids matters. It matters now, and it matters especially into the future. Now, we knew we needed a pathway to support kids whenever, wherever, so we got to work creating on an online training implementation infrastructure for Reading Corps tutors and for Math Corps as well. It was an impressive amount of work, huge payoff. It meant our tutors could continue to work through their partnership with schools, with students and families. Today, we're serving thousands of kids. Some of them are in school, some of them are at home, some of them are alternating. And as we were doing this work, it occurred to us that we could leverage that online infrastructure to deliver support directly to families. So if you're a family and your kid is not at a Reading Corps or Math Corps school, it means that you can come directly to Reading Corps and Math Corps to get your student support. And so we're an organization that's proven year after year that we can get the job done. You know, our programs are in peer-reviewed journals, they're in best practice guides, and most importantly, they're recognized by our school partners as game changers for kids. And I don't love it when we have to showcase these things because as Minnesota, boasting makes me uncomfortable, but it's really important now. And we're just so excited and grateful to be part of our state's effort to meet the educational needs of students. And a special thank you to Representative Hassan's bill that contains an increase for some of the supports that Reading Corps and Math Corps provide. So thank you very much for your time. I know we're all limited here.
Thank you, Dr. Nelson, for your testimony. Up next, we have the Executive Director of Ignite After School, Carrie Dennison Kanine.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. My name is Carrie Dennison Kanine. I'm the Executive Director of Ignite After School, and we're Minnesota's statewide after school network. We don't offer after school programs, but bring together both public sector nonprofit providers from across the state. And I'm speaking to Section 5, Subdivision 7. And I want to thank Representative Hassan for including after school as a key strategy in this bill to address COVID-19 related learning loss and social and emotional wellness of young people. There's a lot of research to demonstrate that after school and summer learning programs can address learning loss, and that when young people regularly participate, it can have such dramatic impacts as closing the math achievement gap in elementary school by grade 5. And during the COVID-19 pandemic, after school programs across the state have been providing lots of support for young people, and we're really excited to be a part of this bill to continue to do that. And for time's sake, I want to turn it over to two of my colleagues who are going to share a little bit about their program. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we have Michelle B. up next.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Madam Vice Chair, and members of the committee. I am Michelle B. I'm the youth media manager of Pillsbury United Communities. I'm also a participant of Pillsbury Youth Programs as a young person. So when I was a kid, I was a member of those programs. It is where I found my purpose to serve youth through arts and cultivating creativity. I currently lead an internship with KRSM Radio, our organization's community radio station in the Phillips neighborhood. Both the station and Pillsbury United Communities aim to serve Black, Indigenous, immigrant, and community members of color. Our interns have been able to explore different professional positions in broadcasts. Most importantly, they have learned new skills and tools to express themselves through a community platform through our radio station. During this past summer, my organization was tasked with the challenge of adapting our programming to the needs of youth during a global pandemic and local uprising in response to the death of George Floyd right here in Minneapolis. Also, during the summer in 2020, there have been multiple teen murders and suicides right here in Minneapolis. And I want to emphasize that there have been teen murders. So teens have been being killed and dying and killing themselves right here in our city. That's what our youth are dealing with. Typically, our summer would have consisted of groups of interns. They would have been in person with hands-on learning experiences. They would have explored their community, learned the significance of community involvement, projected their voices on the radio to their family and friends. They also would have made meaningful relationships with their peers and adult mentors, lasting relationships. I would also like to focus on the importance of relationships and youth work. As a youth working professional, the Adverse Childhood Experience Study, or ACEs, has always been a body of work that I believe to be useful and influential in serving youth. I myself have experienced a great deal of traumatic events in my own childhood. One of the most critical strategies to help youth heal from such compounded trauma and live an emotionally healthy life is meaningful relationships with adult mentors and their peers. COVID-19 has stripped us of all of that. I knew that I had to exhaust my resources and stretch my capacity to adapt to the moment that we were in then and that we are still in now. I tripled the amount of interns in my program. I developed a curriculum that adapted to various learning styles and interests. What was most critical and by far the most important was figuring out a way to truly connect with them, to bring them into engaging and exciting experiences. With limited funds for our programming, we have had to exhaust our resources and energy to do the best that we possibly can under the circumstances. But it is not sustainable. We fear that without help, we will deepen the disconnect that our youth are suffering from right now with distance learning and shelter in place. I'm especially concerned for Black, Indigenous, and children of color who are most vulnerable and most impacted. I believe that this bill will have a tremendous impact not only on my program, not only on Pillsbury United Communities, but on any youth program in the state of Minnesota. Adding to the capacity of youth work as a whole will ensure, most definitely ensure, the survival and wellness of our children. Thank you, Madam Chair, Madam Vice Chair, and the committee.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Lewis King with the North Star Network.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I put in front of you this slide from McKinsey, which showed that kids could lose up to 12 months of school learning, and our kids are approaching 12 months out of the classroom as we speak. If we don't do anything to give them services that help increase their learning, our workers of tomorrow and the future will be hurt. And we will not have a workforce that will keep our community strong. Therefore, we implemented a STEM district, an ecosystem of programs that allow kids to get engaged in after-school weekends to prep for their lives and also to stimulate academic involvement. We also put on the road what we call the BEAST, which is the Mobile Innovation Lab, taking STEM to kids. And this is applicable in rural areas as well. And then finally, we have the learning pods. We currently have 300 children enrolled in these community-based Zoom learning labs where they get tutors from all over the country, college kids from HBCUs, local, the churches are involved, the YMCA is a partner. And we want to make sure that they don't get a life, that they don't get a serious lapse. We've surveyed our parents, and now they're concerned that their children will need more help when they go back to school. So we're revising the model to supplement the educational system and also focus on the gains that children can make. In the previous period that we're ending now, as they go back, we left all the instruction up to the district. We prepared tutoring for the kids to help them with their homework. In the future, it'll be based on where they actually are and what help they need to supplement the classroom learning. We appreciate the opportunity to participate with Ignite to encourage you to pursue funding for after-school programs. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Before moving on to more public testimony, there were several letters that were received as part of the testimony, which have been provided to members and are also posted on the committee webpage. Just want to take a moment to thank those who wrote letters in lieu of live testimony. Up next, we have Hope Melton.
Can you see me?
Nope, but we can hear you. Please proceed.
Okay, I will. I testify before you today. My name is Hope Melton. I live at 4825 Valley View Road in Edina. And I testify before you today in regard to House File 4. And thank you, Representative Hassan, for this bill and especially for your caring for children with mental health and trauma issues and disabilities. This is about one young woman who is my granddaughter. Her name is Hope Margaret Melton. Because of an underlying health condition called neurofibromatosis, or NF1, she was born with learning, cognitive, and emotional disabilities, and her immune system is compromised. She was held back a year in first grade in the Edina Public School System, and Hope has been on an IEP in Edina Public School since first grade. As she neared graduation from Edina High School, her parents were advised to enroll her in the 3-year Vector Transition Program, which is a continuation of her IEP. This 3-year program, supported by Edina Schools, provides essential independent living and job skills training. It enables young people like Hope to live independently, becoming responsible and productive taxpaying citizens. Last year, Hope's parents were informed that in spite of her excellent progress, and she loves the program, she would be unable to complete it because she will age out. As things currently stand, she will be expelled from the program this June in 2021. Due to the pandemic, Hope will be unable to complete the critical job training component of this program. Specifically because of her compromised immune system, the fact that she repeated first grade, and prospective employer unwillingness to host trainees at this time, she has been unable to date to participate in the final job training component of the program. Not being able to complete the program leaves mission critical elements of it unfulfilled, and thus substantially degrades its overall effectiveness for the vulnerable children that need it. It is unreasonable and unfair to deny young vulnerable people like Hope and many others the chance to complete the Vector program. The COVID-19 pandemic has caused unforeseeable disruptions in educational programs, and this legislation, thank you, Representative Hassan, will mitigate the negative effects of the pandemic on disabled young people. Thank you for your time and attention to this issue.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have the Policy Director with Ed Allies, Matt Shaver.
Good afternoon, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. My name is Matt Shaver, and I'm the Policy Director for Ed Allies, a statewide education advocacy nonprofit. We partner with educators, families, and communities to ensure that every young Minnesotan has access to a rigorous and engaging education. A month ago, I was teaching fourth grade at Hall Elementary in Minneapolis Public Schools, and it's with those kids, my kids in mind, that I quickly speak to you today. So I began this distance learning school year as the only fourth grade teacher at my school with a class of 29 students. All kids are great everywhere, and my kids in particular proved it by showing up each day eager to connect and learn. However, my kids were also dealing with the pre-existing conditions of poverty before the pandemic and our collective inability to adequately teach all kids to read well at an early age. After effectively missing the last quarter of their third grade year last spring, not a single one of my students came to me in fourth grade reading on grade level. They range from kindergarten to early third grade in their reading skills. This range in reading levels certainly didn't happen on purpose, but it also didn't happen by accident. It's something that we as adults did to them, or rather didn't do for them. My kids made reading growth this fall, but there's a lot of work left to be done to get all kids growing and achieving again. And we at Ed Allies see HF4 as a down payment in policy and investment on getting my kids, our kids, what they are owed by all of us. And so there are a number of provisions in HF4 that would help to address learning loss, accelerate learning, and support students with long-term recovery. And I want to echo the support on funding, flexibility, extended time, and prioritizing students with disabilities for in-person learning. And I want to highlight and emphasize high dosage tutoring in research-based best practices as being a major lever for my kids. And I can think of many of them who will benefit greatly from that investment of time and resources. So we at Ed Allies applaud these first steps and thank Representative Hassan for her work in ensuring that students have the resources they need to address learning loss and to plan for long-term recovery. Thank you for your time and thank you all for your public service, especially right now.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Paula Cole with Educators for Excellence.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you very much, Chair Richardson, and all members of the committee and the community present today. My name is Paula Cole, and I am the Executive Director for Educators for Excellence Minnesota, otherwise known as E4E, and we are a teacher-led nonprofit, and we have a little bit over 2,000 members in the state. Prior to moving to this role last July, I was a Minneapolis public school teacher, and I was teaching last spring when the pandemic started and we were all sent home with our students and trying this thing called distance education. Since those first few months, Minnesota teachers and our members have been advocating for students. Unfortunately, the most impacted students are still being left behind. I speak of the students who are behind academically, but I also speak of the students who have special need education, and also those students who are experiencing homelessness, poverty, trauma, emotional distress, and so on. This is why I'm so excited to see House File 4 and the commitment that you have made to meeting the needs of all of our students. I would like to highlight the importance of the following provisions: extended learning time opportunities, trauma-informed school incentive grants, and also full-service community school grants. This summer and into the fall, our members surveyed all the teachers, and they used everything that they gathered from those interviews and surveys and used it to put together how teachers are experiencing, and something came really to the forefront, and it's really how students who are homeless, who are living in poverty, have been really not making much of this school year, and that's why we believe that extended learning opportunities are going to be imperative coming next fall to help our students get caught up as much as we can. These provisions could have a profound impact on most of our students, and I will encourage this group to take what is here and to really think critically about how our communities will be part of these trauma and community school grants in the planning, implementing, and the evaluating process so that we don't end up with more of the same. To end, really, what I want to bring to your attention to is a lot of what's happening right now is a result of the current system. We do have a lack of diversity in teaching force, so this is a really good bill. I also want you to think about, because I know this is not the only bill you'll be thinking about in the future, is how we can also add on to this initiative, increasing teacher diversity, which will benefit all the other areas. Thank you for your time. Good afternoon.
Thank you for your testimony. Before we move on to member questions, we currently have three members in the queue for questions. Just a reminder that we will be taking the roll call at 2:25, and also a reminder that the fiscal impacts around this bill will be discussed in Education Finance. Representative Erickson, we have you first up.
Thank you, Chair Richardson and committee, and thank you, Representative Hassan, for bringing forth this proposal. It is primarily funding, though, so I was hoping that we would be discussing more policy implications that are going to affect our children, as I hope most of them return in person to our schools. So, you know, just some questions to raise and for you to think about, Representative Hassan. You know, and to tell the committee that my members and I also have a proposal that we hope you'll hear as we bring forth ideas for reopening our schools and helping our children who are left behind. And I think that's more than we realize, to catch up or to at least get to a place where they're going to have success to begin the next step in their education. So, you know, I want us to think about, you know, formative and summative testing as far as policy measures that we want to recommend be included in a policy bill that is similar to this. The Reading Corps and the Math Corps can provide, I think, some really great inroads for us, but those tutors are going to have to know that in some cases, they're going to have to be knowledgeable of some very basic reading skills. Another is what Dr. King was talking about, the pods and the labs that he has created, and what a great creative idea that is for us to look at when we honor Ignite, which is a marvelous organization that can do a variety of these things. But I hope that they will think in terms of creative policies, because as Dr. King pointed out, that can reach so many of our children, and that's across the board. It doesn't make any difference what their identity is considered. We want to address the needs for all of our children. But again, the policy implications, IEPs, I think any student that has an IEP should be in the classroom and should have been in the classroom. And so where have we lost ground by not following what, you know, it's normally a policy that we have. The additional education programs that we're going to need, and the fact that the commissioner is going to be determining if it's the grants, I think is really problematic.
And I think we heard AMSD address that. And so I hope that we give further thought to, you know, how will we determine where the needs are and for the students who may have experienced trauma. And, you know, that's not going to be all students, but we might think it's all students right now. Once our children are back in the classroom and they're interacting with their peers and they're getting a chance to experience more of their activities, they're going to move to more of a normal lifestyle. So I want us to think about that. Full service community schools, you know, can always be formed within a community. I'm not sure that our spending will be best there. But I think that's something we also need to think about. What are the policy implications for that? So in addition to that, let me turn my page here because I've been writing notes all over the place. How are we going to identify, you know, what policy do we need to identify children who have been left behind? I mentioned testing at the beginning, but we need to know what the data is already that's out there so that, you know, teachers are ready to move forward knowing where their students are and to where they need to get them. I think that home visits are important and the policy implications in students with disabilities is really quite good. I think that we want to be careful about limiting to level 3 or level 4 when we have so many needs in our disability community. So Madam Chair, with all of that said, I don't think I'll raise any questions that are more specific than what I've raised. You know, we have to address the hearts and the minds of our children when we think about trauma. We can't leave out the fact that clergy is also very important. So I hope that as the grants are laid out in specificity, that there will also be that opportunity for schools to reach out to their religious communities to find support for our children who may have experienced trauma during this time. So thank you, Madam Chair, and I hope that we will have further discussions on policy in the future.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rep. Hassan, for bringing this. I do want to ask a question really quickly as for the people who were supporting Section 3 with the extension of time for school, either in the day or around the year. One of the things that wasn't talked about when we talk about the barriers is food insecurities and transportation. If we're going to keep kids longer, if we're going to keep kids throughout the summer, you know, there's no indication and policy that we're actually going to expand our transportation need. I know in my community, we really struggle finding bus drivers for the already current days and schedules. So I'm just wondering if that's something that in your communities or somebody who works in greater Minnesota, we feel like maybe that's one of the pieces we're missing right now in this extension.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. I'll maybe go to Denise Dietrich from the Minnesota School Boards Association. Would you be able to answer that question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just echo your concerns. As I refreshed my memory, as we do every legislative session on different issues, that is one of transportation is a barrier to extended time. So we would, and then of course, as you very eloquently pointed out, if you are going to have extended time, you do need to provide nutrition and other type of supports as well. But that is why our position is just provide as much flexibility as you possibly can so that we can work through those things at the local level. And we would need to have future discussions, I think, with people like you and the chair about what types of flexibilities do we need to have in order to make the learning experience valuable.
Thank you. And so just a minute before we need to vote, Representative Wozlowick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will just briefly address the question, and then if I need to follow up offline, I can do that. I'm just wondering, I think Ms. Holden had mentioned having conversations with families about getting in-home services, and I'm wondering if she could maybe speak to what some of the reasons were behind why the schools couldn't provide those services.
Maren Holden, 30 seconds.
Thank you so much, Chair Richardson, and thank you, Representative Wozlowick, for the question. You know, I think that there are a lot of complicated circumstances. MDE has made it possible for, or has opened up the option, and they did this in September, for districts to contract with qualified community providers to provide in-home services to students with disabilities who need them. I've heard from some districts, and there are many district folks here who could probably speak to this better, but that there are some concerns about liability with doing that, some different contracting issues. I have heard of some districts who have done that on a wholesale basis. I think the District of Duluth contracted with an entire residential services provider that was willing to sign up qualified family and friends, even of children who have disabilities, to then get them enrolled as a like a PCA-like provider, but to provide school-based school services in the home. That's again why, you know, I think this statewide solution, the statewide approach is so beneficial, because we do have seen different things in different districts who are facing different circumstances. Thanks for the question.
Yes, thank you for the response. We're now going to move on to the vote, and I'm going to ask Representative Hassan to renew her motion.
Madam Chair and members, I thank you for this opportunity today, and I want to thank everybody, all the testifiers. I know we're very short on time, so I won't take more time. I just want to say that all the stakeholders and members who have concerns or questions, I am open to, talking offline. And now, Madam Chair, I renew my motion to re-refer House File 4 as amended to Ed Finance.
Thank you, Vice Chair Hassan. Again, because we're meeting remotely, we will be taking the roll, and I will move it to Ellen in order to take the roll on House File 4.
Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hassan?
Aye.
Representative Erickson?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski?
No.
Representative Bennett?
Aye.
Representative Berg?
Aye.
Representative Bowe, excused. Representative Christensen?
Aye.
Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Jordan?
Aye.
Representative Keeler?
Aye.
Representative Moeller?
Aye.
Representative Mueller?
Aye.
Representative Poston?
Aye.
Representative Scott?
Aye.
Representative Ertl?
Aye.
Representative Wasliwick?
Aye.
Thank you. So with that, the bill has been re-referred to the Education Finance Committee. Thank you to all who gave testimony today, including our public testimony providers. And with that, there is no further business before the committee. We are adjourned.